Roots of Conflict. This is take two. Last time we saw that the roots of conflict in the Middle East go so deep that they're traceable all the way back to Abraham and his children, to Ishmael, who was to become the progenitor of 12 princes who really represent the Arabs today. We have seen that the most ancient religions of the region were actually pagan, and then that the first monotheistic religion that came into the region was that of Abraham, of Isaac, and of Jacob. We have seen the origins and the roots of Islam. We have seen about the life and times of Mahomet and the rise of Mohammedanism, or Islam, as it is called today. We have seen the histories of some of the regions, including the earliest inhabitants of Palestine, and how those who dispossessed them, that is the Israelites, when they came out of Egypt and inherited the promised land, did not eject Arabs at all, but some of them were actually of Hamitic stock. And we saw that some of them were also Japhetic, as in the case of the Hittites of the region. Jesus Christ of Nazareth says that Jerusalem is the city which is going to ignite the spark that will result in the conflagration that will be World War III. His disciples asked what would be the sign of his coming and of the end of the age. And he began by telling them that all of the buildings that they saw, the temple and all of its other buildings in Jerusalem, would be so utterly demolished and destroyed there would not one stone be left standing atop another. In the prophecies of Matthew 24, Luke 21, and of course Mark 13, the famous Olivet prophecy of Jesus Christ, we read of how Jerusalem is to be the very focal point of the great events that are going to lead toward World War III, the Battle of Armageddon, and the Second Coming of Jesus Christ. Today, Jerusalem is called the Holy City by nominal Christians. It is revered as one of the holiest of all cities, although Mecca is their holy city. Jerusalem is one of the holiest cities, with the holy sites of the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Dome of the Rock Mosque that is there in Jerusalem on the part of the adherents to Islam. It is, of course, also an extremely important and holy city to those who believe in Judaism, Orthodox Jews and Zionists, who see that in Jerusalem is to be eventually the very kingdom that they hope will be set up, because, of course, they rejected Jesus Christ and still pray for and look for a Messiah to establish a great kingdom that they see in the prophecies of Jeremiah and of Isaiah and of Ezekiel and Zephaniah, the book of Hosea, the book of Daniel. Of course, the Jews look at the Old Testament scriptures, and at the time of the establishment of the great kingdom of the Jehovah God that they believe they are worshiping, even though they have rejected Jesus Christ, and they see all of those prophecies about the establishment of the kingdom of God on this earth, not in the context in which Christians do, with Jesus Christ at his helm at all, but in a completely different light with a Messiah that they still expect is eventually going to come. So here you have the three great monotheistic religions of the world in conflict continually in Jerusalem. Now, it is also political. It is political in the sense that every one of these people have claims that go back into the many, many centuries. The Arabs' claims, they say, are based upon centuries of occupation. They claim that they were even there before the time of the Jews. They claim that they have legal grounds for Jerusalem to become their capital city. On the other hand, the Pope himself has said that he hopes to declare eventually that Jerusalem will become a corpus separatum, or an internationalized city, not anyone's political capital, but a city which will be taken completely out of the political realm and will be an internationalized city open to all faiths. The scenario that appears to be shaping up in the Middle East is covered in prophecies we will come to in due course on this tape, and they have to do with Matthew 24, Luke 21, the 12th chapter of the book of Daniel, dealing with the Great Tribulation, also with 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter, where we read of an individual who is called the Great False Prophet, who will be ensconced in what is called the Temple of God, and will have the power to perform great miracles, so that he will deceive millions of people and will claim that he is God. This is the false prophet of prophecy. His protection will be guaranteed by the beast power, that is a 10-nation combine that will come into Palestine and occupy Jerusalem. In the 21st chapter of the book of Luke, Jesus Christ said, "When you see armies surrounding Jerusalem, then know that the desolation thereof is nigh." That's Luke 21 and verse 20. However, in Matthew's account of the Olivet prophecy, he said, "When you therefore shall see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet stand in the holy place, whoso readeth, let him understand, then let them which be in Judea flee into the mountains." And then he went on to say in verse 21, "For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no nor ever shall be." Those events are going to happen at the same time. A great false prophet, the head of a great world religion, will proclaim that he is the very divine representative of God and probably declare that he himself is godlike, or even that he is God. He will have the power to perform such great and phenomenal miracles that millions will be deceived. And it won't just be weeping statues or a shroud of Turin or some appearance that someone talks about. It will be some of the most fantastic miracles that none of the scientists, none of the news analysts or anyone else can in any way disclaim them. All of this is going to lead toward the Battle of Armageddon. And the Battle of Armageddon is going to lead toward the second coming of Jesus Christ. Now, before getting to those prophecies, let's go back to the very roots of conflict in the Middle East. It's very important to understand how it was that nominal Christianity and eventually Islam arrived in Egypt. It was the Muslim conquest of Egypt that eventually drove out the Romans, who had captured Egypt from the Seleucids, who had overthrown the Ptolemies, a lesser line of Pharaohs, who governed Egypt. The history of Egypt is as old as the history of civilization itself, as you know. Much is found concerning Egypt in the Bible, not only historically, but also prophetically, as we will see a little later on. It was not until the end of 639 A.D. that the sword of Islam hacked its way into Egypt, many centuries after nominal Christianity had flourished there. This is important. Centuries after a major church was established in Alexandria, after the first century of the Christian period. Get that. Understand it. It was many, many centuries after Christianity had spread all over Egypt that the sword of Islam eventually hacked its way there. And that was not until the end of 639 A.D. Now, do you know that Alexandria, Egypt, was second only to Rome for a very long period of time in the early first few centuries of Christianity? Do you know that the quotations that Jesus Christ himself used when he was quoting from the Old Testament were taken, and it's proved by the writings, it's proved by the very language he used in the New Testament, that it was taken from the Greek version of the Old Testament called the Septuagint, and that is merely a word that means the 70, and they were 70 scholars who were sent to Alexandria, Egypt by Ptolemy Philadelphus, and set to the work of translating the Old Testament into Greek. Today, all of North Africa, from Morocco to Egypt, including Tunisia, Algeria, and Libya, are nearly 100% Islamic. But it was Judaism which first made major inroads into the heathen religions of Northern Africa. Then, nominal Christianity, which made inroads in its own turn. Egypt never again achieved the grandeur it had enjoyed under the pharaohs when it was a world power. Rather, it has been ruled by other major powers virtually from that time until the very recent past following World War II when the British protectorate came to an end. A thumbnail sketch of Egypt from the time of the first waves of invading Muslims until the 19th century is as follows, and I'm quoting now from the Encyclopedia Britannica, 11th edition, volume 9, pages 90 and 91. Quote, "A question often debated by Arabic authors is whether Egypt was taken by storm," and that would be by Amr, the commanding general of the second caliph of Baghdad, Omar I, "or whether it was taken by capitulation. But so far as the transference of the country was accomplished by first taking of Alexandria, there seems no doubt that the latter view is correct. From 639 to 968, Egypt was a province of the Eastern Caliphate and was ruled by governors sent from the cities which at different times ranked as capitals. Like the other provinces of the later Abbasid Caliphate, its rulers were, during this period, able to establish quasi-independent dynasties such as those of the Tulunids who ruled from 868 to 905. I won't read all of this, but it shows how eventually Egypt became a part of the Ottoman Empire and was governed by pashas sent from Constantinople. Nominal Christianity first spread into Egypt, principally to Alexandria, however, in the first century. And again, I emphasize it was not until 639 that the religion of Islam arrived on the scene. Now we get to the Bible. Baptized believers who were in Jerusalem on the miraculous day of Pentecost in 31 A.D. returned to their homes and spread the truth about Christ's resurrection and about their own experiences, their own testimony about events they had witnessed, because many of them were present and heard Peter and saw the other apostles and saw the flaming crowns of fire that descended upon their heads, heard that great roaring noise like a mighty rushing wind, and heard their testimony, that is the testimony of the apostles, that Jesus Christ of Nazareth had in fact been resurrected from the dead. Here's what it says in the second chapter of the book of Acts, beginning in verse 5 and reading to verse 11. And there were dwelling at Jerusalem Jews, devout men, out of every nation under heaven. Now when this was noised abroad, the multitude came together and were confounded, because that every man heard them, that is, all of them, all the apostles, speak in his own language. And they were all amazed and marveled, saying one to another, Behold, are not all these which speak Galileans? And how hear we every man in our own tongue, wherein we were born? Parthians, and Medes, and Elamites, and dwellers in Mesopotamia, that would be modern-day Iraq, and in Judea, and Cappadocia, in Pontus, in Asia, that would be modern-day Syria, Phrygia, and Pamphylia, in Egypt, and in parts of Libya around Cyrene, and of course that's Libya and the Cyrenaican Peninsula today, northern Africa, and strangers of Rome, Jews and proselytes, Cretes and Arabians, notice that, we do hear them speak in our tongues the wonderful works of God. Acts 2:5-11. So, there were Jews and proselytes from all over what is modern-day Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Turkey, Syria, Egypt, Libya, and all the way across North Africa who were present in Jerusalem on the day of Pentecost, 31 A.D. Many of them went back to their native lands and spread the truth of Christianity, the truth of Jesus Christ and of his resurrection. The Coptic Christian religion no doubt began with some of these first century converts, as well as did the, quote, religion of Abraham and the religion of Jesus Christ find its way to Saudi Arabia and in places such as Mecca and Medina, which is where Muhammad, well after that time, clear down into the 600s A.D., during his lifetime, encountered many Jews who claimed they were adherents to the religion of Abraham, or Judaism. He encountered both. He encountered Christians, and he encountered Jews in that area in the 600s. The Coptic Christian religion no doubt began with some of the first century converts, as well as with the Ethiopian eunuch, and you read of that in Acts 8:26-40. Therefore, Christianity began to lift the veil of polytheistic paganism in Egypt and throughout the Middle East, as well as the entirety of the ancient Roman Empire, listen, more than 600 years before the conquering sword of Islam arrived. So when you hear about some of these ancient claims, especially with religious overtones, always remember that Christianity was there 600 years before Islam. The Copts, the people of Ethiopia and Eritrea today, are really some of the purest survivors of the ancient Egyptian race. The word Copt is of European origin. It's a corruption of the Arabic word kibt, K-I-B-T, or kubt, K-U-B-T, which in turn comes from a Greek name for Egyptians. It merely means Egyptians. And the Copts themselves call themselves simply the people of Egypt or Egyptians. It was acknowledged that the Copts, now mainly in Ethiopian Eritrea, are the purest survivors of the ancient Egyptian race. The Encyclopedia Britannica says this, quote, "The beginnings of Christianity in Egypt are obscure. The existence of it among the natives, as opposed to the mixed Greek population of Egypt and Alexandria, which produced so many leading figures and originated leading doctrines in the early church, can be traced back as far as the Decian persecution, A.D. 249 to 251. The scriptures were translated into Coptic, or Egyptian, as they call it, and it's a kind of a flowing script that the Copts use today, not later than the 4th century. A religion founded on morality and with a clear doctrine of life after death was especially congenial to the Egyptians. Thus, the lower orders in the country embraced Christianity fervently, while the Alexandrian pagans were lost in philosophical speculation, and Neoplatonism, that is the religion or the philosophy of Plato, was spread among the rich Greek landowners. The Copts had little interest in theology. They were content to take their doctrines prepared for them by the subtler minds of their Greek leaders in Alexandria. Now, listen to this. You know about the Nicaean Council, or the Council of Nicaea, do you not? The Council of Nicaea is extremely important from several points of view. Number one, it was the real beginning of the universal church's adoption of the doctrine of the Trinity. It was Athanasius who came up with the Athanasian, the creed in which he claimed that God is three in one, and it was a very convoluted document, but it was accepted by the Council of Nicaea. It was also the Council of Nicaea in 325 A.D. that said Christians should no longer Judaizing by observing the seventh-day Sabbath and other customs such as the Passover on the 14th of Nisan. Well, the Greek leaders in Alexandria elected Athanasius and his following of Greeks and Copts, who then went to the Council of Nicaea, where they argued against Arius and Arianism. But in 451, the banishment of Dioscorus, Patriarch of Alexandria, by the Council of Chalcedon created a great schism, the Egyptian church holding on to the monophysite tenets. Now, monophysite means one physical being, and the term refers to the Coptic belief about the nature of Christ, which they recite in Coptic Mass. If this sounds a little bit confusing, bear with me for a moment, but this is the exact words that they use every time in Coptic Mass, which is the Coptic Christian church or the religion down there, which in some ways is like Roman Catholicism, but in other ways quite distinct, and of course they do not recognize the Pope. They say, every time they take Mass or Communion, quote, "I believe that this is the life-giving flesh which thine only Son took from the holy Mar. He united it with his divinity without mingling and without confusion and without alteration. I believe that his divinity was not separated from his manhood for one moment or from the twinkling of an eye." End quote. The Melkites, against whom the Copts were in great opposition, rejected that creed, choosing to adopt the Orthodox Eastern liturgy. Their name really meant royalists, from a Syrian word, Melka, that meant king. You'll recognize that in Melchizedek, king of Salem. The controversy over the single or twofold nature of Christ between the Melkites and the Copts ultimately rent apart the nominal Christian church in Egypt. Athanasius is famous for the Athanasian Creed, proposed, as I said earlier, at the Council of Nicaea in 325 A.D., which is still essentially the statement concerning the obscure Trinitarian nature of God accepted by most of the mainstream Protestant fundamentalist churches today. If you want an in-depth study of that, and you want to really understand how they propound that doctrine and why it is not a biblical doctrine, then get your copy of our book entitled God is Not a Trinity. All you've got to do is to call 903-825-2525 for your free copy of that booklet, or write to us here at our address, Garner Ted Armstrong, Box 2525, Tyler, Texas, 75710. In brief, the religions which in turn held sway in Egypt were, first, the polytheistic paganism of ancient Egypt, followed by the pantheism of Greeks and Romans, followed by the spread of nominal Christianity and the Coptic Church, followed by Islam some 6 to 8 centuries later. That should clear up a major difficulty for a lot of people, because the average American seems to believe that Islam, or Mohammedanism, the religion of the Arabs, is far more ancient and spreads all over North Africa and all over from Egypt to the gates of Vienna from early times, and that is not true. It was not until late in the 6th century, on into the 7th, and eventually the 8th century A.D. that Islam began to spread into those regions. From shortly after the death of Muhammad, various dynasties emerged which eventually ruled over the entire Middle East. At the height of the Ottoman Empire, the Islamic religion held sway from Vienna in Austria to well within India. The eldest uncle of Mahomet was Abbas, who lived from AD 566 to 652. His family regarded themselves as rightful heirs of the prophet Mahomet in competition with the Umayyads, the descendants of Umayyah, who claimed the same right. And in this is the roots of the controversy today between the Sunni Muslims and the Shiite Muslims, and it is Shiite Muslims who are predominantly active in Iran, and many of them are the fanatical suicide bombers, the fundamentalist terrorists, who will assassinate leaders such as the late president of Egypt, Anwar Sadat, and other leaders, and they claim to be the rightful successors of the true religion of Muhammad. The word caliph, by the way, means successor. Shortly after the death of Mahomet, various arguments ensued as to who was his rightful successor, who was the caliph. There is much history available to any serious student of the caliphates and the gradual development of Islam. But in brief, the citizens of Medina believed themselves to be in charge of their own affairs, and following Mahomet's death, wanted to appoint one of their own as caliph or successor. Of course, today the term gradually came to mean ruler more than successor in a religious sense and began to have a political connotation. There became three main divisions of the Mohammedan rulers in the East who were caliphs. They consisted of the first four caliphs who were the immediate successors of Mahomet, the Umayyad caliphs, and the Abbasid caliphs. I won't read all of this because it can be quite boring, but eventually all of the history leads us down to the time of the Seljuk Turks in the 10th, 11th, and 12th centuries, and then eventually to the time of the Ottoman Empire. We want to come forward now to the time when a real upset between monks in Jerusalem threatened to rend apart the Ottoman Empire and brought about the Crimean War. And I think it is fascinating because even as far back as the days of Tsar Nicholas and the days of the great powers in Europe and about the time of the United States Civil War, there was strife between Greek Orthodox monks and Roman Catholic monks in Jerusalem, and as a result, it led to a major war. The Ottoman Turkish Empire ruled the Middle East for about 700 long years. And it's very important to note in passing that not once during that vast period of time was there ever a suggestion on the part of any of the Arab or Turkish leaders that a separate Palestinian state be established in Palestine or that Jerusalem be made a political capital. During the many centuries of the Ottoman Empire, the sword of Islam advanced from Vienna, conquering much of the Balkans, one time extending, as I said, all the way from India, where Pakistan is Islamic and India is, of course, Hindu, and that is the reason for the division of those nations, all the way from India to Austria. It would require a very large book to detail only a portion of that vast history, of all the intrigues, the wars, the treaties, the treachery, the murder and assassinations that occurred. As an illustration from that immense and detailed history of the roots of the present-day conflict over Palestine and Jerusalem, listen to this excerpt from the Encyclopedia Britannica, 11th edition, concerning the Tsar of Russia's interest in Turkey, as, of course, geography naturally required and as past wars and conflicts demanded. I'm now quoting. By his concert, that is, Tsar Nicholas of Russia's concert, with the other powers in the affair of Mehmet Ali, the Tsar had abdicated his claim to a unique influence at Constantinople, and he began to revive the idea of ending the Ottoman rule in Europe, an idea which he had only unwillingly abandoned in 1829 in response to the unanimous opinion of his advisors. In 1844, he took advantage of a visit to England to propose to British ministers a plan of partition, under which Great Britain was to receive Egypt and Crete, Constantinople was to be erected as a free city, and the Balkan states were to become autonomous under Russian protection. This proposal, as might have been expected, only served to arouse suspicions as to Russia's plans. It was politely rejected, and the whole Eastern question slumbered until early in 1850 it was awakened by an incident trivial enough in itself, but pregnant with future trouble. Listen to this: a quarrel of Catholic and Orthodox monks about the holy places in Palestine. The geopolitical fallout from this quarrel became immense. Now listen to this, because it happened in 1850. And think of what has happened in very recent years in the Balkan states with the disintegration of former Yugoslavia. And what is all of the trouble there over? What is it about? What was that protracted war about? All of the bombing and shelling of Sarajevo, all of the assassination of helpless victims, actually being tortured and starved in prison camps, almost like reminiscent of Adolf Hitler's camps during World War II. And this took place in Bosnia-Herzegovina. It was and is a struggle between Muslims and nominal Christians. The Serbs have been very much supported by the Russians from time immemorial. They look the same, they use the same alphabet, they speak a very similar language, and Russia has been very supportive of the Serbs. Now here was Tsar Nicholas wanting the hands of the Ottoman Empire, the Turks, off of the Balkan states. And what triggered it was a quarrel between Catholic and Orthodox Greek monks over the holy places in Palestine. The geopolitical fallout from that quarrel was immense. It eventually resulted, as we're going to see, in a division of the entire region, a vast area from Austria to Pakistan, by the three major powers, Russia, France, and Great Britain, who emerged victorious following the wars of the next 50 years, including World War I. Long prior to the birth of Muhammad, the nominal Christian religion had laid claim to holy places in and about Jerusalem. Monasteries were founded, cathedrals built. With the eventual splitting of the Catholic Church into Greek Orthodoxy and the Roman Church over the iconoclastic controversy, inevitable competition between those two churches occurred. Remember, nominal Christianity preceded the faith called Islam in Palestine by about 800 years. Today, the source of strife is the conflict between Islam and Judaism, with the nominal Christian world looking on in deep concern because of the vital energy resources in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states. Early on, the conflict was between Greek Orthodoxy and the Roman Catholic Church, and between both of them and Judaism. Islam was the last to arrive on the scene. As a result of the strife between those Orthodox monks and Catholic monks in Jerusalem in 1850, Napoleon III handed the Ottoman government in Constantinople a formal demand for the restitution of rights of Catholic clerics in Jerusalem. It was now clear that no less an issue was involved than a contest between France and Russia for paramount influence in the Middle East, a contest into which Great Britain would inevitably be dragged. And that's important. Britain's interests were primarily economic, even though the period of the Crusades into Palestine were fueled by religious strife. Concessions were made, during which the British government urged a compromise upon Constantinople, in which Protestants and Mohammedans were given equal rights, with the Ottoman Turks providing protection. Neither Napoleon nor Nicholas really wanted a settlement, though. Napoleon wanted a war because he wanted to expand the French Empire. Nicholas wanted a war because he wanted to kick the Muslims out of Europe, especially from the Balkans. The influence of Islam in the Balkans planted the seeds that have blossomed into genocidal wars for centuries, including the disintegration of the former Yugoslavia in only the last few years. Now, Nicholas believed France would never come single-handedly to the aid of Turkey. Austria, and that became the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, remember, of World War I import. Austria, he thought, would be bound at least to benevolent neutrality by gratitude for the aid given it in 1849. The King of Prussia would sympathize with the Christian Crusade. Great Britain, where under the influence of John Bright and Richard Cobden, the peace-at-any-price spirit seemed to be in the ascendancy even then, as it was again prior to World War II, Tsar Nicholas believed would never intervene. Nicholas even hoped for the active sympathy of Britain. Early in 1853, the Russian army was mobilized, and a Prince Menshikov was sent to present the emperor's ultimatum concerning the holy places in Jerusalem at Constantinople. On April 22nd, the French, British, and Russian ministers came to an agreement on the holy places. Menshikov nevertheless delivered his ultimatum to the Ottoman government, and on that same day, Russian troops crossed into the Balkans. Isn't that fascinating? That a pretext was used over religious strife and who was being treated right and mistreated and so on in the holy places in Jerusalem, and that pretext was the reason for the beginning of a war in the Balkans and the Crimea. Russian troops crossed into the Balkans. That caused a major degree of excitement in Britain, where the government still attempted to preserve peace in a region, but it was too late because Russia wanted the Ottomans and Islam out of the Balkans. And you remember that prior to the Bolshevist Revolution, Russia, that eventually became primarily atheistic and said religion is the opiate of the state, Russia had always been Orthodox. It was not Roman Catholic. It was Russian Orthodox, perhaps as slightly distinguished or differentiated from Greek Orthodox, but it was extremely similar. And when you see even some of the churches that are right there, the basilicas in the Kremlin itself and around Red Square, you can see the buildings that are absolutely testimony to the spread of the nominal Christian religion and Greek Orthodox religion to Russia and to the Balkan states. Well, eventually, because of Nicholas's desire to use the pretext of a squabble over the holy places in Jerusalem to launch a war, the Crimean War came about. The Turkish government declared war on Russia in the beginning of October that year, and French and British fleets passed through the Dardanelles with a clear message to Tsar Nicholas that so long as the Russians didn't pass the mouth of the Danube, the status quo would be maintained. To Nicholas, this was tantamount to a declaration of war, because he never had any intention of stopping at the mouth of the Danube. The Russian naval forces attacked and slaughtered a Turkish squadron in the harbor of Sinope in the Black Sea, which resulted in the combined French and British fleets entering the Black Sea. The war only came to an end after British and French troops landed in the Crimea in Russia in 1854, and the Treaty of Paris was signed 2 years later in 1856. Here were its provisions, quote, Russia abandoned all pretensions to exercise a protectorate over the Christians in Turkey or to an exclusive right of interference in the Danubian principalities, and that means modern-day Bulgaria, Hungary, and Serbia, among others, to which Bessarabia was restored. Notice the name, Bessarabia. The navigation of the Danube was made free and placed under the supervision of an international commission. The Black Sea was closed to warships while open to the commercial flags of all countries. The Asiatic frontier between the two empires, Russia and Turkey, remained unaltered. Turkey was admitted to the concert of Europe. The treaty further provided for a large measure of local autonomy for the Christian communities in Jerusalem, and that included Protestant, Catholic, and Greek Orthodox. Fanatical outbreaks of violence by Mohammedans against Jews and Christians in Jeddah or Jeddah and in Syria, however, resulted in the French landing in the area and occupying it, which in turn resulted in autonomy for Lebanon, which was French-controlled for many, many years and spoke the French language. A Christian governor was appointed by the three triumphant powers, and the arrangement lasted for many years. Now, we're coming very quickly down to the fairly recent past as we study in to the roots of conflict in the Middle East. As you will remember, the bloody civil war that destroyed Beirut, Lebanon, which used to be called the Paris of the Middle East, and I was there when it was in its heyday, and it was a beautiful city. And that civil war that took so many lives was primarily a clash between Maronite Christians, the Falangists, and Islamic fundamentalists. In 1958, the United States was dragged into the conflict when U.S. Marines landed in Lebanon and remained from May until October of 1958. The history of Lebanon's civil war between the Maronites, Falangists, and other Christian groups and the leftist Muslims and Palestinian groups is a bloody, disgusting, repelling story. Over 60,000 were killed, billions of dollars of damage incurred during that 75-76 civil war. Israel twice occupied Lebanon. In 1983, some 50 were killed in a terrorist bombing of the U.S. Embassy, you might remember. And on April 18th of that year, 241 U.S. Marines and 58 French soldiers were killed in a massive suicide attack on their barracks. To this day, Israeli soldiers continue to occupy a portion of southern Lebanon, where frequent terrorist attacks and Israeli retaliation in the form of air and sea attacks and artillery barrages have driven up to 500,000 civilians from their homes. But those civilians, many of them, are Palestinian Arabs that are living along the southern border with Israel and Lebanon. And, of course, from their villages and their camps are sponsored and spawned some of the terrorist raids that are launched inside of Israel today. The Ottoman Empire joined with Austria-Hungary and Germany during World War I, which eventually resulted in a victory by Britain in Palestine when General Allenby defeated the Turks in 1917. Now we come to the very poignant recent roots of strife and conflict that are really argued by the Arabs, and especially Palestinian Arabs and Jordanian Arabs, concerning the rights of the Palestinian Arabs in Palestine. Lord Balfour's declaration was accepted, which provided for a Jewish national homeland. The various caliphates and the Ottomans had been in control of Palestine and Jerusalem for hundreds of years until that time. Never was there a move on the part of the Caliphate of Baghdad or the Ottoman Turkish Empire to provide for a separate Palestinian state. Never was there a move toward making Jerusalem into a political capital. Resulting from the Balfour Declaration, significant Jewish immigration began in 1920, about 10 years before I was born, when a British Palestine mandate was established. The tide of refugees and immigrants swelled considerably in the 1930s as Jews began to flee Hitler's Nazi Germany and other nations in Europe. In 1922, the land east of the Jordan was detached from the Palestine-British mandate and became known as Transjordan. When the truth about the Holocaust became widely known in the closing months of World War II, the civilized world was absolutely astonished. Millions of Jews had been systematically starved, gassed, and cremated in concentration camps all over Germany and Eastern Europe. Names like Auschwitz, Buchenwald, Dachau, Majdanek, Belsen are etched into the minds of generations. The Yad Vashem, the Jewish Holocaust Memorial in Jerusalem, is a museum that impacts the visitor as no other. The life-size pictures and documentation of Nazi atrocities become deeply etched into one's mind and stir the emotions unforgettably. You can take my personal word on that, because I remember breaking completely down and crying like a little boy when I was treated to a trip privately by the proprietor of the Yad Vashem, who was a member of the Israeli Knesset or Parliament, and I interviewed him for our television program at that time. The impact of that emotionally was absolutely unforgettable. Now, in this regard, you need only to research the dozens of titles available about that infamous period to really understand it. The world found a collective conscience when in 1947 the United Nations voted to partition Palestine. Like other attempts at big power partitioning of antagonists, one of the latest being the disastrous attempts to do so in the case of Bosnia-Herzegovina, and the Clinton administration promising originally, even though we procrastinated and dragged our feet for months and months and months and allowed the war to go on, eventually injected American troops under the UN flag into the region, and they're still there as I speak now. So there have been disastrous attempts by big powers at partitioning antagonists and trying to separate people who hate one another and want to kill one another. And the partitioning plan was doomed to failure from the beginning in Palestine. The United Nations, keenly aware of the continuing turmoil there, set up a special committee on Palestine called the UNSCOP to to study the problem and suggest, and I'm quoting now from that document, such proposals as it may consider appropriate for the solution of the problem in Palestine, end of quote. A majority view was that the big power mandate for Palestine that had been done earlier should come to an end as soon as possible, and that two states should come into being, the one Jewish and the other Arab, that economic union should occur, but that Jerusalem should be excluded from both states and made into a corpus separatum or separate entity so that it would not be a political capital for either state, but continue to be an open city with free access to adherents of the three great monotheistic religions. The Arabs rejected that proposal. I'll repeat that. The Arabs rejected that proposal. The Jews agreed, but made it plain they disagreed on the exclusion of Jerusalem. UN Resolution 18111, dated November 29, 1947, agreed with the majority view of UNSCOP and urged that the armed forces of the mandated territories be evacuated from Palestine no later than August 1, 1948. Well, because of the many attacks by the Irgun, the Palmach, and the Haganah against British officers and troops, the kidnapping of British officers, and various terrorist attacks over a protracted period of time, the British decided to get out a little early. They withdrew from Palestine on May 14, 1948. On that very day, the Jewish National Provisional Council, as it is called, proclaimed that the State of Israel now exists. They sent a cablegram to the Secretary General of the United Nations on the following day. That declaration is as important to Israelis as is the 1776 Declaration of Independence to Americans. I will excerpt it, but it states, quote, Eretz Israel was the birthplace of the Jewish people. In the year 1897, the first Zionist Congress proclaimed the right of the Jewish people to national rebirth in its own country. The right was recognized in the Balfour Declaration, 1917, and reaffirmed in the mandate of the League of Nations, which gave international sanction to the historic connection between the Jewish people and Eretz Israel, and to the right of the Jewish people to rebuild its national home. On the 20th November, 1947, the UN General Assembly passed a resolution calling for the establishment of a Jewish state in Eretz Israel. This recognition by the UN of the right of the Jewish people to establish their state is irrevocable. This right is the natural right of the Jewish people to be masters of their own fate, like all other nations in their sovereign state. Accordingly, we, by virtue of our natural and historic right, and on the strength of the resolution of the General Assembly, hereby declare the establishment of a Jewish state in Eretz Israel to be known as the State of Israel. The instant the Jews declared their own state existed, Egypt, Jordan, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia all sought to destroy the fledgling Jewish state. The Jews were attacked in Galilee. They were attacked and completely surrounded and cut off in Jerusalem. They were attacked in Gaza. They were attacked on the Maritime Plain. They were attacked in Jewish villages and cities all over, up and down the length and breadth of that tiny fledgling state. But they fought their way through all of that war and against a combined six-nation army of the worst all those Arab states could throw at them, and they emerged victorious and actually gained territory in the doing of it. A famous book by Leon Uris entitled Exodus, if you haven't read it, is really a fantastic book to read about that period. It was later made into a major motion picture, and it lends vivid color to the period of post-war Jewish immigration to Israel and their war for independence. To this day, when I go there, and I've been there not very recently, but a very few years ago, when I drive up that steep, winding highway, it's now a fairly wide freeway that goes up from the Maritime Plain to Jerusalem, you can still see those wrecked hulks there of not only armored army-type vehicles, but even civilian trucks that had sheet metal put on their sides, and they have been liberally sprayed over the years and painted with red lead, so the red rusty paint is visible. And those wrecked trucks have been preserved as a memorial because they are the remnants of that armored relief convoy that fought its way to Jerusalem. Many Israelis died in that attempt, but a number of the vehicles finally succeeded in reaching the surrounded, desperate defenders of West Jerusalem. Had the convoy not managed to fight its way through Jordanian armed forces who were ensconced on both sides of the road on the heights, and if you look at that, a chill will go up and down your spine because it is heavily wooded, boulders and rocks everywhere, and the Jordanian soldiers commanded the heights and could snipe at those Jews as they drove along the road down below. The story of another ancient roadway that went around from a different direction, and the armed force that managed to utilize it, and even by dint of hard labor and by hand labor, managed to get some of their trucks through there, has been written by Leon Uris. It is very interesting reading, and I certainly highly recommend it. Instead of being annihilated or completely driven into the sea, as the combined Arab army stated their intention, the Israelis gained territory. Following Israel's War of Independence in 1948, and this is very significant, listen, get it in your mind, get out a map, look at it, study the geography, come to understand it. Egypt occupied the Gaza Strip. Jordan occupied the West Bank and the Old City of Jerusalem. Syria occupied the Golan Heights all the way to the very precipitous slopes overlooking the Sea of Galilee. From 1948, after that war was over, until 1967, a span of 19 years, UN forces occupied a demilitarized zone between the Arabs and the Israelis. A swath of land was declared no man's land and was festooned by sandbagged machine gun emplacements and barbed wire. The white-painted military vehicles of the UN patrolled the region. However, frequent terrorist raids occurred. Israeli farmers were shot while they tilled the fields near the Sea of Galilee by Arabs ensconced on the steep, precipitous slopes of the Golan Heights. Terrorist attacks were mounted from Egypt and the Sinai, from Gaza, from Syria, from Jordan, from the West Bank, from southern Lebanon. Another war resulted in 1956 when Israel invaded Egypt's Sinai as a result of terrorist attacks. For a short time, the British and the French entered into that war, and British and French troops were actually sent there because the Suez, if you remember, was blockaded by the sinking of ships in that narrow passageway, vital to British economy. A UN ceasefire was arranged by November 6th, of 1956. Again, a very brief war, but with terrible consequences. The Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan occupied the west bank of the Jordan River. Syria occupied the Golan Heights, and Egypt occupied the Gaza Strip. Now listen to this, and never forget it. Never did the three Arab governments propose the creation of a separate Palestinian state in any of these regions or in any aggregate of them. For one thing, one of the major sources of income for Jordan was tourism. The old city of Jerusalem, Hebron, and Bethlehem, among other sites, were favorite tourist attractions and crowded with pilgrims from the West during Christmas and Easter holidays. Amman was the capital of Jordan. Jordan never proposed setting up a separate state for the Palestinians or making Jerusalem anybody's political capital. When the 1967 war broke out, it was as a result of Egyptian demands that the UN emergency force occupying the Gaza Strip be withdrawn. The UN acquiesced, and Egyptian armed forces promptly reoccupied Gaza, then closed the Gulf of Aqaba to Israeli shipping, trying to hurt the Israelis economically. Once again, combined Arab armies sought to destroy the State of Israel. Israel destroyed the Egyptian Air Force, catching most of them on the ground. There was a stunning victory at the famed Mitla Pass in the Sinai. Israeli warplanes caught huge Egyptian tank columns in a bottleneck and destroyed them. Israel achieved major victories over massive Syrian forces in the Golan that were equipped with Russian tanks. They drove Jordan's Desert Legion from the old city of Jerusalem in the West Bank, and after just 6 days of violent fighting, the UN arranged a ceasefire between the warring parties. Israel now, as a result of that war, occupied the West Bank, which is true today, and the Golan Heights overlooking Galilee, which is true today, the Sinai, not true today, I'll get to that in a minute, and the Gaza Strip. However, you'll remember the Egyptians and the Syrians launched a sudden attack against Israel once again on Yom Kippur in 1973, on the Day of Atonement. For many years, Israeli forces had been dug in along the famous Bar-Lev line on the east bank of the Suez Canal. The defensive fortifications were reminiscent of the Siegfried or the Maginot lines of post-World War I fame, featuring concrete artillery emplacements and a huge 100-mile-long berm of bulldozed sandbag banks with linked defensive hardpoints. Egyptian forces successfully brought up high-pressure hoses and breaching equipment and managed to break through the line, spilling into the Sinai. In the initial phases of that bloody and violent war, both Syria and Egypt seemed to have the upper hand until a major counterattack by Israeli tanks in the Golan drove the Syrians back. The Israeli army crossed the Suez to the south, outflanking the Egyptian Third Army, and was headed toward Cairo when the Soviet Union and the other major powers began calling for a ceasefire. Israel withdrew from the west bank of the Suez in 1974. Anwar Sadat was the president of Egypt at that time. Now, I want to interject here. A brief personal experience, which I have always believed may have had something to do with the major events that followed, including the Camp David Accords and a formal peace treaty between Egypt and Israel. You see, when the 1967 Six-Day War broke out, my father, Herbert W. Armstrong, and I were en route to Jerusalem. I had left Pasadena, and I was in England preparing to go on to Jerusalem, where our radio program was to be broadcast to the Middle East for the first time. A Mr. Adlai Mukhtadi, who was head of the Jordanian Broadcasting Corporation, had arranged for a contract with a station in Jerusalem, which was then in Jordanian hands. We were inspired. We were elated. We were thinking now for the very first time in centuries the gospel of the kingdom of God could be preached over an Arab-owned Middle Eastern radio station, and my father and I intended doing the first few inaugural broadcasts in person from the station. When the war suddenly broke out, Mr. Mukhtadi, who has remained a close personal friend, lost a very fine home, which I have seen, in East Jerusalem. He found himself back in Amman, Jordan. The radio station was now no longer in Jordanian hands, so the war brought an end to our plans for a broadcast going to the region. Mr. Mukhtadi is a Palestinian Arab. He is a very fine man, very intelligent. He is an advisor, counselor to the Jordanian government to this day, has a lovely family, several of whom live and work in the United States. He and his wife, Saida, were here to visit us in our offices near Tyler in 1997. He's a very prominent individual among leaders in the Middle East and remains a consultant, as I said, to the Jordanian government. His eldest daughter was personal secretary to Crown Prince Hassan bin Talal, King Hussein's brother. In late 1976, when I asked Adlai Mukhtadi to help arrange a special series of television interviews with President Sadat, he went to Egypt and began setting up the meeting. He told me it would be necessary for me to meet a number of other officials there of the cabinet and the government before I would be able to interview Mr. Sadat personally. It required two trips for me to finally interview the president and the first lady of Egypt, which I finally accomplished. On the first visit, Mr. Mukhtadi had set up interviews with several major officials, including their Speaker of the House, who was later assassinated by terrorists in Cyprus. I also interviewed the publisher of Al-Aram, the official Cairo daily newspaper, and several other cabinet-level members of the government. I told all of them that I was completely apolitical, that I intended presenting both sides of all issues fairly, and these and many other meetings were necessary to reassure the Egyptian government on that point. I was invited to a private dinner in the home of former Secretary General of the United Nations, Boutros Ghali, who then resided in Cairo. On my second visit, I was able to interview both First Lady Jihan Sadat in Cairo and President Anwar Sadat in the Presidential Palace in separate interviews. Our TV crews shot hundreds of feet of footage all over Egypt, at the Suez Canal, the pyramids, and in Cairo, and we put together a one-hour special television program which was shown all over the United States, entitled Egypt Under Sadat, and another half-hour television program that was also featured and contained excerpts of the interviews. Pictures of the interviews and the president's letter of thanks to me are in my possession. That letter is framed and occupies a place on my office wall. Now, of course, all of my questions were directed toward the Sadats regarding the Middle East, Egypt, Israel, and the other Arab nations, the past wars in the area, and, of course, with the future, and with my assurance that I would present their point of view fairly, and I did. Following our formal on-camera interview, I had an opportunity for a freewheeling discussion with President Sadat, who told me very feelingly of his past, of his family, and especially about his younger brother, who had been an officer in the Egyptian army during the Yom Kippur War and who had been killed in the fighting. Mr. Sadat said he was like a son to him and explained the large age difference and how he had helped raise his younger brother. He was obviously moved by the loss of his brother. He spoke of how he had died a hero fighting for Egypt. Mr. Sadat had a very visible callus in the precise center of his forehead from his five times daily prayers as a Muslim. All the big billboard pictures of him in Cairo and in the press always showed that callus very clearly. He smoked a pipe during the interview and the discussion that followed. His voice was a very deep bass, a low rumble. He was personable, likable, intelligent, a man of the people. Anwar Sadat had come from a small village along the Nile and risen to become an officer in the Egyptian army. He became vice president of Egypt during the presidency of Gamal Abdel Nasser and succeeded him upon Nasser's death in 1970. He was very proud of having ordered the Russians out of Egypt. He told me of a secret trip he had taken to Moscow and of how the Egyptian armed forces had become too dependent upon the Soviets for equipment and spare parts. The Soviets were attempting to exert too much influence and had a large number of diplomats and military advisors inside Egypt. Because he was angered over their attitude and angered over the fact that spare parts weren't forthcoming, Sadat ordered the Soviets to pack up and leave. He was the only modern leader to ever do so. Very large numbers of Soviets and their dependents were forced to leave Egypt in only a matter of days. His wife, Jihan, had spoken to me of her first trip to New York. She had gone there with her daughter and was tremendously impressed with the power and strength of America. She told me of her personal impressions of the United States and how she had said to her husband upon her return, "Anwar, why are we fighting with these people?" Of course, she referred not to actual fighting, but the political debates that had taken place over the years as the United States continued to be a mentor and supporter of Israel. I had not really planned to say anything specific to President Sadat other than the questions I had submitted for the interview, but somehow the moment seemed right. Israel had turned over the Sinai to Egypt 2 years previously, not only handing back Egypt's domestic oil supplies, but enabling them to become an oil exporter. That had been a tremendous conciliatory gesture on the part of Israel. Our on-camera interview had covered the entire geopolitical spectrum of the Middle East, of which I was keenly aware. So I said this, "Mr. President, why don't you just go to Israel? Why not get on your airplane and just fly there and tell them you're on your way? You would go down in history as a great leader who helped bring peace to the Middle East." I told him, reminding him how Egypt has the largest Arab nation in population, in labor force. I said, "The Israelis are like a brain trust. Here is a very high per capita proportion of doctors and scientists and educators and engineers. Why not combine the large Egyptian labor force with the skills and expertise of the Israelis for the mutual benefit and prosperity of all?" I went on for some time about the tragedy of war and about the great benefits to be had by peaceful cooperation. And, of course, I didn't have any need to remind him of the poverty and squalor that was everywhere visible in Cairo. Well, he began to tell me that he couldn't go to Israel. He didn't name any specific organizations, but he talked about the danger of doing such a thing because it would stir up outrage among his own supporters and his own people. He talked about his political enemies and how they might use such a move on his part to their advantage. He also indicated that he felt he might be rebuffed by the Israelis, and I specifically remember saying, "But if you just went there, if you told them you were coming for personal talks, what would they do? They wouldn't dare shoot down the personal airplane of the president of Egypt." I mused aloud about how the entire Middle East could become a major power on the world scene, and how if real cooperation could occur among the Arab states and that Israel would cooperate, that all of them would benefit, that even a kind of a loose-knit United States of the Middle East could eventually be created, which would be of great benefit for all. Well, at length, our meeting came to an end, and I've carried vivid memories of it in my mind ever since. I cannot help but wonder, in retrospect, if I planted some seeds of thought in his mind which led to his later actions, because, you see, within only months of our talk, and that was early in 1977, in November of that year, President Anwar Sadat, in a surprise visit, went to Jerusalem to meet Prime Minister Begin of Israel. The Camp David meetings followed. Then came the signing of the Camp David Accords at the White House with President Carter, and a formal peace treaty was signed between Egypt and Israel on March 26, 1979. When the Sadats came to Washington, my wife and I received a formal engraved invitation to a reception and a banquet in honor of the Sadats. We responded to it. We flew to Washington, D.C. from Pasadena and joined with several dozen others who were also attending. When my wife and I walked up the wide staircase with the many other guests, it was to find the Sadats in formal attire in a receiving line, and Mrs. Jihan Sadat greeted me warmly, met my wife and greeted her warmly, turned to her husband as he finished speaking to the one just ahead of us and said, "Anwar, it is Mr. and Mrs. Garner Ted Armstrong." President Sadat said, "Of course," and shook our hands very warmly. I was able to mention to him that I had talked to Dr. Henry Kissinger, whom I met at a reception in Dallas, and how I had conveyed to Mr. Kissinger how Mr. Sadat had told me, "I trust Henry." He had spoken of his many meetings with Henry Kissinger during Kissinger's term as Secretary of State. And we had only a few moments to speak and then moved on into the banquet hall. And there I met and shook hands with Senator Nelson Rockefeller, former Secretary of State Cyrus Vance, Senator Hubert Humphrey, all of whom told me they listened to my television program. And incidentally, I was able to meet ABC's Barbara Walters, if that's interesting to anyone in passing. At that time, our television program was on a very good station at a very good time in Washington, D.C., and I had no doubt whatsoever that it was viewed in the White House on many occasions. It was only 2 years later that I was deeply shocked and very painfully grieved when I saw that brutal assassination of Anwar Sadat on television in 1981. He was dressed in a military general's uniform, reviewing the Egyptian army, which had cracked down on militant Islamic fundamentalists only a month earlier in September. It was a bright, brilliant, sunny October day in Cairo, and a very proud one for Mr. Anwar Sadat, when suddenly some of the soldiers passing in parade rushed up to the reviewing stand and began spraying the crowd with submachine gun fire. President Sadat stood up, faced them, held out the palms of both hands, and shouted, "No!" just as several bullets struck him. His murder resulted in the arrest of some of the conspirators, and they eventually were themselves executed. Vice President Hosni Mubarak succeeded Anwar Sadat, and of course Hosni Mubarak is the president of Egypt to this day. Unlike other Arab nations, Egypt has cracked down on Islamic fundamentalists and terrorists. During the 1990s, a number of Islamic terrorists have been captured, tried, and executed. President Mubarak himself narrowly escaped assassination during a visit to Ethiopia in June of 1995. The Egyptian government blames Sudanese fundamentalists for the attack. Obviously, they don't want to blame elements within their own country, although probably they understand privately that there is a direct connection. Now, as mentioned earlier, the citizens of modern-day Egypt are not ethnic Egyptians, but Arabs. From ancient times, Egypt has been invaded and conquered by foreign armies such as the Hyksos, the Assyrians, the Greco-Macedonians, the Romans, and others. And they are not really ancient Egyptians, but Arabs, and about 100% of them are Muslim. Egypt is going to figure very prominently in the prophecies of the Word of God and in great major geopolitical events at the time just ahead of us in the years just to come. One very important prophecy in that regard is Daniel's 11th chapter that gives us many details of a time yet ahead of us when a great northern power, that is, a coming United States of Europe, a 10-nation combine in Central Europe, which will be the fulfillment of the prophecy of the beast power of Revelation 13 and Revelation 17, verses 12 to 14. That power is going to occupy Palestine and invade Egypt. and you couldn't understand that prophecy until its present context. Why would any power, no matter where you think it would come from, whether you think Russia, Europe, the United States, or anywhere else, even if you think it would be combined Arab armies, why would any such power invade and occupy both Israel and Egypt unless the two of them were somehow cooperating together? Egypt, so far as its Muslim population, is a bitter enemy of Israel. Now, today there is a political treaty, yes, there is a peace treaty, and there is at least some kind of a semblance of some kind of peace between the two. But make no mistake, there is deep hatred in the hearts of the Arabs in Egypt against Israel. Here's what that prophecy says in the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel, beginning in verse 40. And at the time of the end. So note that that prophecy is dated in a sense. That means it takes place at the time of the end. Shall the king of the south, and that was always Egypt during the period of the Ptolemies and the Seleucid kings, push at him. And the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and that means Palestine, modern-day Israel. And many countries shall be overthrown. So there are many other countries in that region, maybe in northern Africa and in the Middle East itself, that shall be occupied by that power. But these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom, and that is probably Turkey, and Moab, probably Iraq, and the chief of the children of Ammon, probably Jordan. The capital of Jordan is Amman. He, that is this king of the north, shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and of silver, over all the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians shall be at his steps. Well, that original Hebrew word is put and Cush, and it may not mean the political entity of Libya and Muammar Gaddafi or Ethiopia today. It may mean Pakistan and India instead, meaning that Pakistan and India would be at his borders or at his steps, that it would advance that far, which means what? It means that one of the countries that would be overthrown or occupied would be Saudi Arabia. And the other countries there to be overthrown and occupied would probably mean all of the countries right to the border of Iraq, including Kuwait and the Gulf sheikdoms, because we're talking about oil. We're talking about the great power of a united Europe having to finally stop a war which would trigger a mad, insane World War III by advancing into that region and occupying those countries and actually forcibly possessing and controlling Middle Eastern oil. It goes on to say in the next verse, but tidings out of the east and out of the north, and Russia and China lie to the north and the east of that region, shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go forth with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many. And that is going to result in the battle of Armageddon that is depicted in Revelation 16, verses 12 through 16. It says in verse 45 of Daniel 11, and he shall plant the tabernacles of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain, and that means between the Dead Sea and the Mediterranean, in Jerusalem. Yet he shall come to his end, and none shall help him. The king of the north, mentioned several times in this lengthiest of all Bible prophecies, was one of the Seleucid kings who divided up Alexander's empire following his death. Eventually, the Roman Empire rose to world dominance and occupied Palestine and Egypt. And if you haven't yet read it, call or write for your copy of our booklet, Who is the Beast of the Apocalypse? And you will see that there is an end-time resurrection of the Roman Empire that is coming, a modern space-age nuclear-armed power that will eventually fight Christ at his coming. The prophecy of Daniel 11 strongly indicates that the king of the north, which is this final beast power from Central Europe, will storm into Palestine, probably occupying Syria, Lebanon, and Israel, then advancing into Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and the other Persian Gulf states until arriving at the borders of Pakistan and India. And that would mean that such a force would possess the bulk of the world's oil supplies. Now, who would be concerned about that to the east? Well, Japan is to the east of that as well. And Japan receives about 70% of its oil from Persian Gulf sources, from Saudi Arabia and the Persian Gulf. So there is a very great deal of significance to that 11th chapter of the book of Daniel, verses 40 to 45, about what is likely to take place in the Middle East and what is going to affect the United States of America and the British Commonwealth and all of Europe and all of the developed world because of Middle Eastern oil supplies. You know, for many decades, would-be prognosticators predicted that the Soviet Union would invade Palestine. And that was because they assumed that the King of the North meant Russia rather than a major 10-nation European power. For over 42 years, I have said repeatedly that a war between Russia and the United States is not prophesied. During the very darkest days of the Cold War, even during the Kennedy-Khrushchev-Cuban missile standoff, when the world believed we were on the brink of nuclear war with the Soviets, I was saying over radio and television and to live audiences numbering up to 15,000 that we would not go to war with Russia. Instead, I continually emphasized that a United States of Europe would eventually emerge in Europe following the collapse of present-day governments and the emergence of military dictatorships. Now, in order for you to truly grasp all aspects of prophecy about Jerusalem, Palestine, and the Middle East, you've got to understand the Olivet Prophecy of Jesus Christ in Matthew 24 and Luke 21. You need to understand the prophecy in 2 Thessalonians, the second chapter, about the great false prophet who will claim that he is God and have the power to call down fire from heaven in the sight of them that worship the beast. And people will say, it is God. They won't say it is a representative of God. You have to understand the prophecies, then, of the book of Jeremiah, of the yoke that is going to be laid upon Israel's shoulders. You've got to understand the place of Germany in those prophecies. And the way to do that is to get that other literature I'm telling you about and take your time and read it and study it in your own home. Let me tell you about some of that literature, which if you have not yet read it, you need to have there in your home and to study it. One of the most important books I think you can ever read is entitled Europe and America in Prophecy. It goes through the entire history of the United States and Britain so far as prophecy is concerned. Where are they mentioned in the Bible? Why would the Bible mention such tiny states as Palestine and Libya and Ethiopia and ignore the world's greatest superpower that has ever existed? Well, it doesn't. And if you get that book, and it is a full book, very important, has a major section in it about the Germans in prophecy, and toward the end of it will give you a step-by-step prophetic scenario of events you can watch for in world events in the next very few years. Europe and America in prophecy. Another very important one I just mentioned is who or what is the beast of the apocalypse? Who is the beast of the apocalypse? A booklet that goes through all of these prophecies about the Middle East, about who and what the beast is, shows you the tracks of the beast from the very earliest days of the ancient empire of Nebuchadnezzar to the Persian Empire to the Greco-Macedonian Empire to the Roman Empire, and even gives you a chart in the middle of it to give you all the dates to take you all the way back to all the various heads of that beast to bring it right down to the time in which we live today and the years just ahead of us. You need to get every bit of that so you truly understand the prophetic scenario. But now at least you know, in this two-part series, what are the real roots of conflict in the Middle East. They are ethnic, they are religious, they are political. Most of the time when we hear of the most recent terrorist attack, our liberal news media in the Western press only seems to take the side of the Palestinian Arabs. Yasser Arafat is hosted in Washington. He visits with our president. He is always portrayed as a person who is talking about peace, peace, and it reminds you of the prophecy in Jeremiah that says the world leaders say peace, peace, when there is no peace. Yet, when Yasser Arafat is standing up in a balcony talking to thousands of his own supporters, and even recently did exactly this, was talking about the killing of a lot of Israelis by a suicide bomber aboard a bus or in a busy shopping center or a coffee shop, here are the people the Palestinians in Gaza shouting with the top of their lungs, God is great, God is great, God is great, and rejoicing because they hear about yet additional helpless Jewish women and children being blasted to bits by a terrorist attack. Now you understand who was there first. And you understand that the Israeli government is not provoking Palestinian response because it desires to build housing inside the sovereign territory of Jerusalem. When I interviewed Teddy Kollek, longtime mayor of Jerusalem, he must have been mayor of Jerusalem for at least 20-some years, he told me when I asked him whether or not Jerusalem would ever be traded like the land for peace process that was put in place by Yitzhak Rabin, whether old Jerusalem or the eastern part of the city would ever once again be given back to the Arabs. And he said they would never relinquish one inch. He said it over and over again, not one inch, not one inch. That is very much the same policy and has been voiced by Prime Minister Netanyahu, who is in deep trouble as I am here in the radio studio talking into this microphone so you can hear this tape. I don't know if by the time you hear this tape, if Netanyahu will even still be in power, because the police over there are trying to get an indictment against him because apparently of a kind of a crony appointment of a very high official in the government, the equivalent of there, or the very same attorney general, because apparently of some desire to get yet another friend out of some charges against him, and they're actually saying that they want to indict the prime minister. And that announcement will come out in only days, so maybe by the time you hear this tape, there's something will have occurred there. Maybe it will be resolved, and maybe Mr. Benjamin Netanyahu will be on his way out. Well, of course, Shimon Peres will be waiting in the wings, and if he can come back into power, then we will see Israel going yet back the other direction, and perhaps there will be some renewed talks about negotiation, even over Jerusalem. I don't really know. But we will have to watch and to see, because that's what Jesus Christ says. He says in Luke 21:36, watch you therefore, and pray always that you might be accounted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass, and to stand before the Son of Man. He said that from the Mount of Olives. He said that from a hill overlooking downtown Jerusalem. Jerusalem is the city that is going to be the spark that ignites World War III. And just as a squabble over the holy places as early as the 1850s led to the Crimean War, just as a squabble over territory and the holy places and deep-seated religious enmity and animosity led toward an attempt by six combined Arab armies to destroy Israel in 1948, just as hatred by the Islamic Arabs against the Jews led to yet another war in 1956, just as that hatred led to another surprise attack by Syria and Egypt against Israel in 1973, so today, the terrorists, some of them so fanatical they will put pipe bombs around belts around their middle and stroll nonchalantly into a busy shopping center with helpless, innocent Jewish women and children and blow themselves and their victims to bits, is all based upon ethnic and religious hatred. Now you know that those hatreds go back into the centuries of the distant past, so far back as the prophecies concerning Ishmael, who was to be a wild ass of a man, his hand against every man, and every man's hand against him, and who was to dwell to the east of his brethren. Isn't it amazing that to this very day, the peoples to the east of Jerusalem are Arabs, who they themselves say are descendants of Ishmael, and that the hatred and the conflict and the war that rages back and forth between these people has been going on for many, many centuries. Be sure to get the booklets that I've mentioned in these two tapes, especially Europe and America in Prophecy and Who is the Beast of the Apocalypse. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.